All right, let's head over to the cloud. Mr. Tom Shepstone on the line with us. Energy Security Freedom, if you'd like to find his publication in the Substack world. You can also find him on LinkedIn. Are you on any other social media, sir, other than Substack and LinkedIn?
We're on X.
Okay.
And also Trump's site, as well as LinkedIn, as you said, and a couple others, but they're pretty, Getter, for example. So we do about a half a dozen different sites where we promote every day our posts. So
I'll tell you what, either next month or the month after, I'd like to do a 20-minute interview just on social media.
Yeah.
On what you're finding out, what I'm finding out, yeah. Ones that work, ones that don't work, because
right.
I'm now even seeing a trend on LinkedIn, specifically with oil and gas professionals, where they're talking about ditching LinkedIn. Too many lobbyists and government employees on there. And that leads us into our first question or comment, if you will, which has to do with one of the articles that you can find at Energy Security Freedom Now. Of course, former journalist, Natural Gas Now, Tom Shepstone, energy consultant for 20, 30 plus years. NGO's biggest scam is what I wrote down.
Yes.
And this is a great topic because I think this is one of the most under-discussed topics happening right now. In fact, in Minnesota, the new leader of the House or the Senate flat out said, don't give another dime to nonprofits because the NGOs have soiled their name so bad. So what made you write this, and tell me the genesis behind this?
Yeah, well, the genesis actually started with when I worked with Energy In Depth. That was back in 2011 through 2013, and we were promoting natural gas development in Pennsylvania, New York, and thereabouts. And I spent three wonderful years doing that on the side from other stuff I do. And as I got into it, I was always interested in who's really behind things. And I, like many people, I originally thought that our enemies were simply people who were ill-informed ideologues. Okay, so when you saw the protesters out there, you know, saying no fracking and talking about all the problems and worshiping Josh Fox and all that nonsense, I really thought they were just uninformed, misinformed, true believer types. And there are a lot of those. There's no question about them. But what they really are, as I learned very quickly, is they're really useful idiots. And I don't mean that in a necessarily a derogatory fashion. It may sound that way. But what I mean is they're people who are naive about what's really going on and who's really supporting them and why. Because what I found out very quickly was that in our case, the Rockefeller family was very, very much involved in funding all kinds of what I would call fractivist activity in northeastern Pennsylvania and in New York State, and as well as other states. I mean, they're everywhere, but they focused on New York in particular, the Catskills in particular, because the Rockefeller family owns vast acreages of land in the Catskills. And they have some, private estates there. They, Larry Rockefeller Jr., who's, John D's great-grandson. He actually bought, 10,000 acres or something like that. And he developed it into a high-class club type subdivision where, only the rich and famous could live. And they bought out everybody, anybody that looked like they were a commoner, they bought them out, and they are scared to death of the commoners, so to speak, getting oil and gas because they can't buy the land on the cheap then. That's one part of it. They like to buy land on the cheap. And one of the things they do with that land, which is the second part of it, is they want to buy anything around their enclave, if you will. And so anything that where they live or they particularly enjoy or they own, they want to buy up the land around that and create a preserved nature or, you know, around them. And what they do, it's a scam, really. What they do is they buy it on the cheap. They then, along the way, get it appraised for a higher price. And specifically, they appraise the value of an easement, in many cases, for conservation. So what they do is they then donate the conservation easement to the state, or maybe they'll donate the land with the conservation easement. Either way, it's the same result. The result is they get a park around their area that the state owns, and they've benefited because they got either money from the state, or they got some special, you know, some special credit. And they just keep redoing this. You know, they go in, they buy up the land, they donate or sell the property, donate an easement, or they sell the property with an easement. And either way, they get paid by the state with an appraisal that generates an artificially high value. And so they just turn, take that land, go out and do it again. And the same thing happens with many forest activities in northwestern Pennsylvania, for example, where people will come, conservation organizations will link up with a timber outfit, a large, you know, national timber outfit, and they'll come in and they'll make a deal with the timber company to sell them the timber, but they'll then apply a conservation easement to the property afterwards and donate it to the state, and, you know, and everybody is screwed except for the trust funder types who are running these NGOs who facilitate all this. And so what we found at that time, I found, was that a handful of families in Pennsylvania, New York, you can count them almost on one hand. You got the Rockefellers, who made their money obviously in oil, but they're now five and six generations down and they hate oil, okay? And you've got the Park Foundation, the Park family. They were a big a journalistic empire at one time. Roy Park and his grandchildren are now running that. And then there's the Heinz Endowments, which, of course, are the ketchup people. John Kerry's wife, who was John Heinz's widow. And then you've got the William Penn Foundation of Philadelphia, which is the heirs of the Haas part of Roman Haas, which was a chemical company, eventually absorbed by DuPont. So, and of course, they created, as you might guess, they created some hazardous waste sites. So you've got the trust funder generation of that group too. So all those four organizations, they're just four of them, but there's a couple more, but they're all working together. They're all coordinating. They're all rich people who are what I would call elitists, who really don't want anything happening around them. They want to make the money off the land. So they go out and they fund all these little rinky dink. Sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
They fund these rinky-dink little NGOs, or maybe they're not even organized as an NGO. They're just, you know, a group. So what happens is you'll get some group, like there was a group up in around Seneca Lake that was opposing a big propane project. There's propane storage. And I forget what they were called, you know, Keep Seneca Lake something or other, you know.
But Tom, let me interject here for a second,
yeah,
because the NGO, at least the ones that I've seen, because what you're talking about is a template being used in almost every state. Now, it might not be the four families that you're talking about, but in North Dakota, for example, it's two families that are controlling the majority of what you just described. And the important part to point out is that I'll bet you dollars to donuts, because I can't afford what the billionaires afford, but I'll bet you dollars to donuts that this group you're talking about didn't start out opposing anything. They were some happiness machine that was going to make your life better. And that's how they got the money. But the end result is always some sort of conflict, some sort of political agenda special interest. So sorry, I just wanted to interrupt you for a second, because that to me, you get so caught up in it, we forget what the original narrative is, not what the result is. And so
I would take it a step further and say many of these groups do fund many wonderful things, and they do it as a kind of a coat of paint to hide what they're really doing. And I think that's what you're saying as well, that if you are out there donating to the local YMCA or something like that, or some church group, that's good cover for what you're really about, which is trying to make money off conservation easements, or whether it's fighting oil and gas, or whatever your special interest is. And one of the big foundations, you and I talked about this several programs ago, and that was Nathaniel Simon set up the Sea Change Foundation. And of course, they spread the money out to several different other NGOs, including some big ones like the Energy Foundation. Well, Nat Simons is the son of Jin Simons, who was the, if you remember, he was the Harvard mathematician, I believe he was from Harvard, who identified and developed a way to trade stocks, using math to essentially capture the value and to predict where the markets were going and all that. So he was a mathematician who made an absolute fortune applying his math to the stock market. And Nat Simons is his trust funder son, and he and his wife, they're the ones, you may recall this, the U.S. Congress actually investigated them as well as some other people. They were parking money down in the, I think it was the, it's not the Virgin Islands, it's
Cayman,
one of the other Caribbean islands. They were parking money there. It's a UK, UK place. And so they were hiding it down there, and they had kind of crazy connections with some of the Russian government and all that. You may recall a little bit of that, but the point is, the Simons family, Nat Simons and his wife, they're heavily invested in solar energy. So this is their special interest. I'm not saying they don't have an interest in saving the planet that's partly legitimate, but their real interest is the solar investments they have. That's what the Energy Foundation, to which they donate about half the income, I don't know how much money it is. I think they donate many millions of dollars. Let's just say it that way. Many millions of dollars to the Energy Foundation represent about half their budget. And the Energy Foundation is all about promoting solar and sticking it to oil, coal, gas, and frankly, anything else that competes with solar. That's what their mission is. And people do not realize, these little groups that are out there, they think saving the planet or whatever their, whatever the mission, they think it's all about purest environmental goals. It's not. It's about the money, there may be a little bit of the purist in there, but not much. It's mainly about the money. Oh. And that's the problem we have with these NGOs. And I don't mean to prattle on, but I want to say on your show, as I said many times on my blog, this is just a huge scandal. Elon Musk said there may be no bigger scandal in the history of the world than what's been done with these NGOs. And I believe it. They have, and they don't deserve the tax exemption they're getting. They should be taxed.
So I want to ask you something, Tom, yeah. Because you've worked in the media more or less through your columns and,
right.
You've been published and so you understand kind of the way that the old media works.
Right.
And the way that the old media worked in the free market system, it was based on subscribers and ratings.
Yes. Yes.
You had to produce in order to get any sort of money, whether it be from advertisers or subscribers or whatever the case is. Now, one of the things that I'm having some serious conversations with colleagues in the media about, because I came from the print industry, and so I went through the 2008 to 2012 paradigm shift where every right. newspaper went bankrupt,
right.
and we had a complete paradigm shift. And what rarely gets talked about is how Too Big to Fail and a couple other bailouts that happened most of that money went to Yahoo, Facebook, Twitter, yes. a lot of right. the social media platforms that gave away the traditional media print for free on right. the internet. And it flat out, I mean, the investment that the banks and the government put into technology really damaged the news industry, the print industry, to where they've never recovered from it. No, I believe that's going on right now with the oil and gas industry through a variety of ways. And I also believe it's going on through traditional radio and broadcast journalism, is the way the NGOs are all of a sudden producing their own podcasts.
Yeah.
So it's very suspicious to me that a company who didn't even exist and has no experience in the media gets government money and all of a sudden produces a small media company, because nobody's listening to these podcasts. Nobody's listening to a salesperson interview their boss. Nobody's listening to a marketing director interview some executive director under the same banner. Now, if they take that money and invest in the traditional media and distribute that with that traditional audience, well, their message could be disseminated in a proper way. But what the government's been doing, and it's so funny how this is happening, they're giving all this money to these startup NGOs that are creating their little silos, and no one's listening. No, and they're going to the same conferences with the same people, and it keeps getting smaller and smaller, but their budgets, for some reason, get bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
So anyway, I didn't mean to ramble there, but we are going to talk about the green grifters. Because what one of the things that you have to do if you are waging a war on someone is you have to take out their communication. And in traditional war, it's the communication tower. But in this case, it's the traditional media. And that's one of the arguments that's happening right now, is the green grifters are waging a war on traditional media through the podcasters and the NGOs and the special interests and those types of things. And Tom, I'd love to know your opinion on that, but also the green grifters, do you believe that they are the ones kind of in control of the NGOs, or do you think it's someone else?
No question. No question.
Yeah.
I mean, I just gave you a good example with Simons. I mean, he basically owns the Energy Foundation, you know, and his Sea Change Foundation it's got a website that's very, you know, just total basics, just like one page kind of website. And but yet he's spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, and he's basically funding all kinds of things, but particularly the Energy Foundation. That's his biggest thing. And it's the same thing with the Rockefellers. Look what they're doing. I mean, they're, you know, there's probably at a minimum, there's a dozen Rockefeller NGOs. And most people, you know, they know, they've heard of the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Family Fund, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, but they haven't heard of the Sustainable Markets Foundation, the Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, you know, a bunch of others. So they've got, I would say, probably a dozen NGOs, and at least 10. So they are just everywhere. And so you know, when you dig into Columbia University, for example, you find they're one of the major funders of different entities within that university. They very much control it. And so the message you get out of Columbia University is always, you know, it's always pro-climate, anti-fossil fuels. And you see that the way they manipulate everything. And then they create their own, they have their own journalism. It's called Inside Climate News. That's a Rockefeller enterprise, you know, and that's exactly what you're talking about, Jason. And oddly enough, that one does get some traction. You know, conventional news reporters will pick up on that and say, well, it's reported in Income or Inside Climate News, which is nonpartisan. Well, anytime somebody tells you they're nonpartisan, you know they're not. You know, if you're nonpartisan, you don't need to say it.
That's exactly correct. It's like the guy at the party that tells you how much money he has. He ain't got any.
And he hasn't got nothing. It's so true. It's yeah. so true.
But you know, the one thing that I think bothers a lot of people in this yeah. is that there's so much tax money going to people who have so much money. So it's gotten to the point to where a lot of times they're not even using their own money. And no, so it's house money. To them, it's becomes a game at that point. Yep. I mean, there's no consequences, there's no accountability.
Nothing.
And what do you do? I mean, and people feel powerless because the amount of money that's been, I've said this for a long time now, since COVID. Well, actually since the Inflation Reduction Act, but if you take the money that was printed from COVID to the Inflation Reduction Act, that is more money than the United States had printed from 1776 to 2020. Yeah. And the government controlled all of that. Sure. So they literally built their own country, their own economy, their own whatever you want to say.
And the worst part of that, Jason, the very worst part of that is when they jumped up the budget from like $4 trillion a year to seven, okay, which they did for COVID, it never went back down. You know, in a normal world, you would have this. And again, I don't, the COVID debacle was one of the great crimes of man in history, you know. But putting that aside, let's assume the money was spent for legitimate purposes, you know. And in a sane world, that budget would have come back down to 4 million plus whatever inflation was involved, you know, afterwards. It didn't. They just jumped it up and never took it back down again. And that is such a crime. I mean, it's like a crime on top of a crime on top of a crime. You know?
But, you know, even from that template, that's one of the issues with these nonprofits is, again, they fail in the free market, but they get funded again. And now that they're starting to compete with the media and they're starting to compete with the private sector in other areas too, mind you, not just the media. Oh, yeah. There, in fact, this morning I was in a meeting because some local job recruiters were ticked off because the local rural government accounting agency, whatever, is having a job fair. Well, there was a company around town that's been doing job fairs for a long time. So now all of a sudden the government's stepping in and, you know,
that's a great example.
Yeah, and they're not advertising with anybody. They're not doing anything. They just got some money, and so now they're competing with the local sector. So that's one of the issues is that from the media standpoint, for example, people are now starting to give money to these nonprofits that are starting these news networks and these different things, and they're able to write off the advertising dollars. They're going to they're going to trade shows and conferences that all of a sudden popped up out of nowhere, and they're able to write off the marketing dollars. I mean, how the heck can you compete with that if you're like the New York Times or if you're the Arkansas Little Rock Journal? I mean, this is some tough stuff to deal with here. My alma mater, NDSU, they started a podcast, and right away they got Marvin Windows flying the podcast kids around in the private jet. I mean, are you kidding me? Wow, that's just incredible. So, you know, the grifters are everywhere, man. But let's talk about the green grifters, because this is a touchy subject. Mm-hmm. Some of them are from the oil and gas industry.
Oh, sure.
A lot of them are from, you know, the green sector, if you will. And some are just people trying to figure out how to survive. And if I got to take that government money, I guess I'll bite my tongue and pride and take that. I mean, Tom, they're coming from everywhere. That's what I'm saying. And so this is a tough one to discuss, because when you put out $5 trillion into the marketplace, you just paid off a lot of people.
And it happens all the time. And the older I've gotten, the more I realize how corrupt our government is. But, you know, but we can't excuse ourselves either. You know, I've written a ton of stuff about how uneconomical and inappropriate solar energy is as a national policy. And it is. It's not the right thing to do. If somebody wants to put it on their own house, on their rooftop, and they imagine that they can reduce their electricity needs, you know, more power to them, but don't ask me for money for it. number one.
Exactly. It technically should be an investment into your family's future.
That's correct.
By reducing your energy. Okay, right. I'm going to spend $4,000 on some energy panels, and over the course of 10 years, I'm going to make back 20. That's the idea. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you want to do that, go ahead. And actually, the solar industry, the rooftop solar industry, would be further ahead if they weren't taking subsidies. They would be, there'd be more innovation. There'd be more things happening that make it more realistic. Okay. I think
I'd agree with that. I'd agree with that.
And they'd be doing better without it, the subsidies. But and the worst part of it was where you were required to sell it back to, and a lot of states are eliminating this now, but required to, you could sell back your excess electricity to the utility who didn't need it at all at retail. I mean, it's so absurd, you know. So it was just destroyed the whole system for everybody. But I think we have to be honest with ourselves and say, you know, I've been on various sides of the solar equation. I've been writing against solar as a general principle because I don't think it's economical. But I've also represented various municipalities, particularly in New York, that have had to process applications. Okay, and I've always tried to be fair to the projects because I would disclose my own feelings and say, you know, look, this is where I stand. But this is a project, and we're not here to decide on solar energy. We're here to decide on the project, you know. And so I actually was involved in several cases where we ended up approving solar projects and then helping municipalities write regulations for it. So when I do that, I'm getting some money out of it. Let's be honest, you know. So I'm getting money where the fees for my services are being reimbursed by the solar company. And when I write regulations for a town, they're paying me out of taxpayer money. And I've also appeared as an expert witness in some zoning cases against solar energy. And I've done some where I supported the projects because the projects were fine. I didn't agree with the principle behind the projects, but the projects themselves were fine from a zoning perspective. So I have to be, you know, intellectually honest and say, you know, somebody could probably call me a bit of a grifter in a sense. You know, I'm not seeking that business, but it comes to me and I take it, you know. So, and that's part of the, that's a societal problem, you know, that it's too easy for everybody to be a grifter. That's really what it's about. And it shouldn't be that way.
But I think in your example, sometimes people don't know when it's coming down second, third hand.
Yeah,
a lot of right. times, you know, that's one of the reasons why during COVID they went through the banks. So nobody could, at the end of the day, blame the government for picking winners and losers. It was the bank.
Right.
I mean, really, that's the truth.
That's a great point.
Yeah, and they did it with too big to fail as well. And so ever since then, they've been basically giving money. The banks have become our deciders. You know, they decided which churches were going to get funded. They decided which businesses we're going to get and who we're going to get what. And, you know, it's kind of interesting that this green grift is just taking on that kind of that old fashioned big bad wolf railroad template.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's almost, there's nothing new under the sun. Go watch Hell on Wheels from AMC and get an idea how the railroad comes in. And well, I mean, Tom, think about it. I mean, like the railroad was offering those Native Americans a better life. Look at where their life is today. I mean, you know, flash forward. And so that's one of the biggest issues that people have is whether it's solar or whether it's the new carbon management industry, it's all based on a greater good. It's all based on a greater good of some people that are making the decisions. And, you know, I mentioned the oil and gas industry before, and Occidental's a great example because their new CEO, Vicky Hulub, I believe it's Hulub, HULLOB, I believe, or HOLLUB. I apologize. I've never met her. I've never interviewed her. I've only gotten her name in press releases. She's one of the first ones to embrace the carbon movement to where they call themselves a carbon management company now. They're not even an energy company.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I take a look at Oxy, which was a model oil and gas company,
yes, it was.
They switched very quickly. And
And they're going to have to switch back, I predict.
They might have to. I don't know. I mean, is that even a thing anymore? Because I'm taking a look at what some other companies are doing too. Mm-hmm. And as they start to get more into the government subsidy business, they don't look like the energy company of old. They start to look like the energy company of new. Monty Bessler, who's, you know, he's with Frackinator. He's been in the oil and gas industry for 40 plus years. He wrote a commentary on LinkedIn on one of our posts on the crude life about how a lot of the new executives didn't work out in the field and didn't have small experience. So all they know is how to get government handouts and government subsidies, and they're executives at the oil companies now. I was going to ask you your opinion on that, but you seem to be shaking your head in agreement.
Oh, there's no question about it.
Talk to me about that a little bit, because that will completely change the industry if that's true.
Well, I think it's true in every industry. It's not just oil and gas. I mean, one of the things I often write about is the fatal conceit, you know, which is the idea that if you're an expert in one thing, you tend to imagine that you're an expert in all things. And the guy who wrote The Road to Serfdom, Hayek, was the one who also developed the idea of the fatal conceit. And that was when he wrote a book called that, The Fatal Conceit. And it's one of the big problems we have with human nature is that intelligent people tend to overvalue intelligence, and they assume that again, if you happen to be good at predicting stock trends, that you're also good at running a government agency. You know, I mean, that's now that may be true in some cases. I think Scott Bessent is doing a pretty good job at Treasury, to be honest with you.
And but for those people out there, Michael Jordan was one of the best basketball players, and he's a horrible coach.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Yeah. So there's always people that are always exceptions, and some people that are good at a lot of things, but nobody's good at everything. Not a single person on earth is good at everything. And yet there are a lot of us who think we are good at everything. And, you know, when you have failures in your life, and if you get as old as I do, you've had a couple of failures or two or three, and you've learned, you know, and it's a valuable experience. You've learned that that's not the case, and you have more respect for everybody, you know. So I think that's the problem we have, is we have a lot. You put your finger right on it when you said you get a lot of executives who've never worked in the field, and think of all the companies that have had problems as a result of that. Some of the car companies, for example, have been that way. You've had, I'm not going to mention any names at this point, but there are several car companies that were going to shake up the world by going to EVs and all this stuff. And look what happened. You know, it didn't work out. Ford, look, you know, this guy's running it, supposed to be a brilliant guy. I don't see it, you know, so I think he kind of took it off in a different direction. Now, I can't say that he's one of those that didn't have the experience, but I think you'll see a lot of companies, Nissan, and I may end up buying a Nissan truck, but I'm worried about Nissan because they're not doing well financially, and they may be absorbed by Toyota, which is a much better company. And you see that problem that you mentioned so many places where they've hired the experts, in quotes. And when you hire experts, you get whiz kids in many cases, which is what Robert McNamara did with that led us into the Vietnam War. You know, I mean, that's what happened. So we have to be very careful about that. And I think it's a serious problem in all industries. One of the things I've always liked about the oil and gas industry, for example, one company that I won't mention the name, but I like very much, and I've done a lot of work with them on different things. They had a fellow who ran the company and came to meetings in blue jeans, you know, and when you met him, and you know, he was comfortable out in the field, you know, and then they got absorbed by a somewhat bigger company, merged with a bigger company, somewhat bigger company. And now the company is run by a fellow who obviously comes from the academic side of things, and or the bookkeeper side of things, and really doesn't really understand the industry, you know. So and it's not fun to watch, you know. It hurts a lot of people, you know.
It really does, and especially when you have an industry that has a level of tribalism and groupthink that is probably right. higher than most right. industries.
Yes.
And yeah, in the way that you're agreeing with me means I don't have to sell you on it. And I've yeah. never had to sell anybody, by the way, on it that's spent a day in the oil and gas industry. It's very groupthink and very tribalism.
Yes.
And
yes.
I do think that's probably the Achilles heel of mm-hmm. the oil and gas industry is, I got to tell you, I felt like the book of Job at times going into a area that I wasn't from and I didn't know anybody. And here I'm trying to point out their faults and how to go more towards the promised land. And boy, they just escorted me right out of town. You know, I mean, but you know, and you know that, I mean, when I was trying to yeah. warn them of the ESG movement and some of this carbon stuff and,
and
they're the first ones that kick your butt out of there. And they're the first ones to go and get the subsidy dollars when they're ready. Yeah. And that's one of the issues that I think that people are having right now is they want to say something, but their job is dependent on it. And so yeah. they won't. And that's one of the ways that the green grift is happening. But you see an area right now, an opportunity, if anybody wants to go to energysecurityfreedom.substack.com, they can read Tom Shepstone's columns, and he also posts other columns, including ones from myself from time to time,
yep.
is that the fracking window is open. So you believe with all the NGOs going on, most of them against the oil and gas industry, and with the green grift going on, most of it against the oil and gas industry, and the only ones that are for it, if you want to call it a grift, are the orphan wells and the carbon sequestration. But you believe that there's a legitimate fracking window that's going to open up for companies, huh?
I do, and this fellow wrote this story. I didn't write it. Is pointing out the reasons, and he's not saying it's definitely going to happen. He just says there is a window there and a strong possibility. I agree with him. I think the battle, you know, the battlefield has changed. It's not the same. You know, most people are comfortable with fracking now. The old Josh Fox, you know, water quality nonsense. I think has long been, you know, dismissed, and I don't think it holds a lot of credibility anymore. And in New York State, for example, it's all about virtue signaling. It's all about, you know, pleasing some bunch of Manhattanites, you know, who don't know anything about producing energy or anything else for that matter, other than making mega bucks in the stock market and such, you know. They're always trying to please them. It's about virtue signaling, but you can't do that forever. You know, virtue signaling doesn't create jobs. You know, New York State's up against it, and because they're high taxes compared to Pennsylvania, for example. They're also, you know, their energy prices are going to skyrocket because they're trying to force out natural gas altogether. They want AI development. It's not going to happen if they don't have power, and you're not going to get the nuclear. I'm okay with nuclear. I think we should develop it, but it's not going to happen quickly. And as a matter of fact, I think some of these states that have downplayed coal are going to see coal. They're going to be forced to use coal. I think some of them, because you're not going to hold back and tell everybody no. You just can't do that. You know, you've got to have some of that AI development, and that's just the latest thing. But it's a very convenient thing, and it makes the point that if you want to have growth and development and higher incomes and better lives, then you're going to have the energy. And this nonsense of trying to depend on wind and solar, which does nothing but raise prices, as you know, it's never free. I just saw an article, again, put out by one of these smaller NGOs, Penn Future in Pennsylvania, funded by a couple of bigger ones I talked about earlier, put out a news release today about how we have to go to solar and wind to save money. And the average person would save $525 a year if we went, you know, we went totally wind and solar. Well, we can't go totally wind and solar. We still need the baseload energy. And what we've done by promoting the wind and solar is we've made the baseload energy less efficient. It's impossible to lower costs in those cases. absolutely impossible to lower costs. I don't care if you put the whole damn thing in for free. And it doesn't cost a dime to put in the wind and solar. It's still going to raise electricity rates because you're taking business away from the baseload generators that you cannot get away from. And so therefore, that's what Germany's learned. That's what California is learning. That's what New York is learning. And so and the whole world is learning, as a matter of fact. England's the same thing. You cannot do this. Promoting an internet or intermittent source of energy and not raise prices no matter how little it costs. And it's not true that it doesn't cost a lot. It does cost a lot. But even assuming it did, prices would still go up. Electricity prices are going to skyrocket no matter what you do because it's intermittent. And the battery storage is not going to do it. It's extremely costly. It only carries you for a couple hours, 3 or 4 hours. And I don't care what anybody says, it's extremely dangerous. You start putting those things in, for example, in the town of Walk Hill in New York State, one of the schools allowed them to be on their property, and they've had 2 fires already. Okay. And so they're not happy. I can tell you the school is not happy. So this is the situation, and reality eventually sets in. It has to, you know, it just has to.
We got one final question for Mr. Tom Shepstone of Energy. Is it Energy Security Freedom? Is that right? Is that
Energy
is that?
Security and Freedom?
And Freedom, okay, at Substack.com. Yeah. So one of the ways that the NGOs have changed the media is headlines and the way that they no longer report as much as they promote. I'm actually trained, you know, went to school, award-winning in newspaper, award-winning in magazines. Right. I was a publisher. And there is a difference between reporting and promoting. And there is a difference between opinion and editorializing and news.
Yep. Yep.
And folks, just so you know, reporters don't tell you what's going to happen in the future. Reporters tell you what happened yesterday or just now. They report on what happened. So anytime you're reading a story by a reporter about something that's going to happen, it's a promotion. And it should be paid for. It should be actually an advertisement.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
That's one way that the news has changed. The other way is the actual just headline writing, like the headline writing of clickbait and some of the other narrative writing. And I'm going to give you folks a little lesson here, and this will be free. Okay. Free education here from Tom Shepstone and Jason Spies in the world of media, because I'm on New York Focus. It's a state's newspaper, one of the nonprofits where a lot of award-winning journalists have gone because it's the last bastion for journalism.
Right. I'm familiar
and,
with it.
Yeah, and I would argue that most of their stuff is probably a little leaning to the left than the right, and that's actually probably an understatement.
Right.
it just is, because they don't even have energy departments anymore. It's environment.
Right.
So it's to that point. But Trump's China tariffs hit New York's clean heat experiment. I can't tell you how much stuff is loaded in that headline for one, it's experiment. So we don't even know if it's going to work. So right there, they're admitting that this is money that's a gamble for the people. Number two, they're blaming Trump and the tariffs before it even happened. They don't even know yet if it's going to happen. So anyway, that's just one example of how the way that my mind works and how it's very difficult for me to read a lot of the news anymore. But I wanted to lead that up, Tom, because what are you hearing? You're right on the border of Pennsylvania and New York. Are you hearing any tariff information that's going to disrupt anything on the grid or energy bills or any clean heat experiments that apparently New York's all worried about from a Chinese company that is behind it?
As you may have guessed from one of my previous remarks about a Nissan, I've been looking at different trucks. I have a Dodge Ram I'm not entirely comfortable with, and so I'm looking for something a little different. And I've been visiting car dealers, and you know what I notice? Every one of them says, you know, you really need to buy now because the tariffs are going to change everything. So does that not tell you something? You know,
Wow.
Everybody has an interest in the story. Everybody has an interest. And you know, as you say, they're promoting the tariffs as a negative because it's a positive to them in the sense that it'll bring in business now, you know. Will it change what they actually charge for a car in the future? I doubt it'll change much at all. If you noticed, there was an article I think last week about VW not changing the price on two of their cars. You know, that everybody was speculating the price was going to jump up, you know, 20-30%, and they said no, it's not going to change. So you know, and I think, and that's what happened the last time when Trump did tariffs on China back in his first administration. The impact was a lot less than everybody thought, because at the end of the day, you have to compete. You have to compete. You know, China can't give up the U.S. market. Nobody can give up the U.S. market. You have to compete. So it's going to be good for them, because they're going to have to learn, like everybody else, how to compete. They've been effectively subsidized for years, by taking advantage of us, charging us tariffs, and being able to sell to us at a lower than normal cost compared to, you know, what they charge us. And that's all going to that's got to change, and it's going to be good for them in the end, because they're going to innovate, they're going to change, they're going to do things differently, they're going to cut costs, you know, and which is what everybody in business does. If something happens, you adapt. If you don't adapt, you die, you know. So that's the way it is in business. And I don't think tariffs are going to have much of an impact on these foreign countries at all, or the prices we pay. I think it will help bring back jobs to the U.S. of A, which is what we need. You know, we got away from the manufacturing, and that had a political element too, because, you know, people in the service business, they don't know how food is made, or food is grown, or energy is made, or any of those things. And by getting back to manufacturing, you're going to get more people who are familiar with making things, doing real things, you know, not doing what I do every day and what you do every day, which is speculate and write. And we enjoy that, you know, and it's valuable in its own right, but we're not making real things, you know. When you get more people making real things, you're going to have more realism in society. That would be my final observation here.
Well, and I think too, it's the tariffs are going to go one of two ways. And you know, there's a lot of different varieties and variables and outcomes, but if we're boiling it down, and if we want to have our hot take or whatever you want to call it, I'm about 3 hours from the Canadian border.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I've got a friend of mine who's married to a Canadian woman, and so their in-laws are in Canada, up north of International Falls, Minnesota area.
I'm about 3 hours from Canada as well.
Exactly. That's why I'm having this story with you, because you'll be familiar with some of the products I'm going to name. So, you know, we kind of joke about things from time to time when he comes back or he's going to run up there. As a kid, I used to love these Macintosh caramels. It was like it was like a brick of caramel. It had like a green and red plaid cover, and it gave you instant diabetes. But man, were they good. So good. And I think I always joke because they pulled them off the market, I think, in America when I was like in fourth grade or fifth grade or something that. And I couldn't find them anywhere, and they were just gone. But my friend in Canada could always get them. Well, and then I find out about this Kraft macaroni and cheese business, where apparently the Kraft macaroni and cheese in Canada is like so sought after because it tastes better, because they use it's like the Mexican Coke. It's better. they use the real ingredients, so it tastes better. So I used to give them a hard time, like, hey, why don't you smuggle me back some of those caramels and Kraft macaroni and cheese? I could sell them. I could sell them out here on the market. Well, then we talk about being caught as an international caramel smuggler, right? So, well, then after the Trump tariffs come out, I'm interviewing Terry Edom from the BOE report. And the day before, Canada comes out and says they're going to boycott Jack Daniels. And so I thought, uh-oh, here comes the bootleggers. You're going to see Jack Daniel's.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And that guy, so I think, number one, you might have a trade war. Okay, you yeah. might actually have a tariff trade war happen because if people boycott American, Canadian, Russian, hey, man, I'll tell you what, some people like Smirnoff vodka. They don't care about the trade war. They want to have it, Grey Goose or whatever. And then the other one, of course, is more of maybe like what Honda and Toyota are doing, which is opening American assembly plants and manufacturing plants. So you're having out-of-state, out-of-country corporations now becoming quasi-American companies. So I see it going one of those two ways, Tom.
I think we're already seeing a lot of the latter. I mean, what, $7 or $8 trillion? I think it's already been invested that by companies who want to be here to avoid the tariffs. Wonderful. And the other thing I think you're going to see happening, and particularly with the U.S. and Canada, I think you're going to see a lot of tariffs just dropped. You know, I think you're going to see a move, a lot of pressure for everybody to go to zero. You know, and which would be a wonderful thing. You know, if we had completely free trade between the two countries, wouldn't that be a beautiful thing?
Oh, it'd be unbelievable. It'd be unbelievable. Yeah.
I think we may get there.
I do too. And next time we'll talk about the Panama Canal and Greenland as well, since that's the next chapter. But hey, how could people get in touch? And tariffs haven't impacted your subscription price, have they? They haven't gone after us, have they?
No, you know, not a bit. So,
but if you want to subscribe to Tom's Substack page, he is accepting paid subscribers, but some subscribe for free as well.
That's correct.
And any final thoughts, sir?
No, I think that's it. We've covered a lot of territory. It's always a pleasure with you. We kind of go off on tangents we both love, and I like the way it always turns out. So thank you very much, Jason.
Well, thank you, sir. And you have yourself a wonderful rest of the day.